Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
I think we're all searching.
There are some people that think that the media would
bias. They're more biased.
Good evening and welcome to Views of the News. This week, the show is going to focus on the news that you, as a listener, reader, and viewer, say you are most interested in, information about your health. We'll also tackle an unfortunate rite of spring, political campaign commercials, both local and national. And we'll take a look at what happens when a very profitable corporation gets a lot of unwanted and negative news coverage. I'm your substitute host, Lee Wilkins, and with me in the Reynolds Journalism Institute studio are faculty colleagues Charles Davis, whose research focuses on open records and freedom of access, and Amanda Hennett, whose scholarship focuses on health communication. But since this is a show that sometimes assumes a traditional definition of news, we're going to start with some of the less savory stuff. In what I'm sure is going to be an early installment of a much longer discussion, we'll take a look at political commercials, both local and national. Locally, successful city council candidate Barbara Hoppe accused her opponent, Bill Tilson, of negative campaigning for a television commercial that questioned her connections to the development of a fraternity house on College Avenue. Nationally, of course, there's the latest Republican National Committee ad that was outed last week for using doctored audio of arguments before the U.S. Supreme Court to make its point. We'll ask whether this sort of campaigning works and what, if anything, traditional journalists can do about this kind of political dialogue. Then we'll update everyone about the latest on Britain's phone hacking scandal and its continued impact on News Corp and the owners of the Murdoch family. Yesterday, James Murdoch, Rupert Murdoch's son, and until the scandal heir apparent, stepped down as chairman of B Sky B, perhaps the most lucrative holding in the Murdoch empire. News reports indicate that the younger Murdoch stepped down in advance of the results of two separate investigations, one of which can determine whether News Corp is, quote, fit and proper, end quote, that's British phrasing, to continue to hold a license to broadcast in Britain. We'll talk about whether the impact of this latest corporate change on News Corp itself, particularly its American holdings. We'll also update you on a story we talked about 2 weeks ago, the very public retraction from This American Life of reports on working condition in Chinese new manufacturing plants that make those Apple products we so love. This American Life's report about specific conditions were inaccurate, but in a twist that journalists understand only too well, an independent investigation of the Chinese manufacturer Foxconn have found the allegations true in many cases. The result? What may be an historic agreement in China to improve both pay and working conditions. We'll talk about this, what this kind of disclosure means, the relationship between accuracy and truth, and what the news media's very messy role in these changes has meant. But we're going to try to spend a substantial amount of the show today talking about something we know others are talking about as well, health news. There are three samples of it on our blog, a link to stories about the latest autism study, a connection to an NPR report about how school lunches are becoming healthier, and a more local link to CNN blog with the latest connection between long-term hormone replacement therapy and breast cancer. These are just three examples of the sort of news that Americans say they want, but making sense of them for journalists as well as audience members can be another matter. And we'll ask Amanda to bring her considerable expertise to bear on the subject. But before we get to the fun, let's get to the ugly. Charles, 6th Ward Columbia City Councilwoman Barbara Hoppe, not you, Charles, won by a pretty big margin last night. Does this mean that at the local level, negative campaign commercials are a bad idea?
Yes. I would think that the sort of Chamber of Commerce junta that runs these candidates and runs these incredibly negative ads would have sort of a regrouping moment where they meet at a local restaurant and think, is this working out really well for us? Because it started, of course, fabulously successful 3 electoral cycles ago when they, I think, seated 3 members of the council.
Including the mayor.
Although I will say the mayor did not run a similar campaign. I want to give the mayor credit. I thought his campaign did not look like Mr. Tillotson's in any respect. I think Mr. Tillotson mined new ground as far as negative campaigning in a local election for city council. I think it was Winston Churchill who said of academics, they fight so hard because the stakes are so small. It reminded me of this campaign. This was Goldwater-esque. So perhaps the fact that he lost in Goldwater-esque fashion may have them revisiting that strategy.
Amanda, you're relatively new to Columbia but not new to city council stuff. What was your take on all of this? I mean, I sort of got to the debate, as it were, late. It's like I read the article in the newspaper and went, oops, I think I missed a TV commercial. And that's sort of how I stumbled into it.
Well, like Charles was just saying, there's just a very low tolerance here for negative campaigning. And I had a chance to stop by a couple of watch parties last night, including the Trap Party, which ended up being a victory party, and they didn't have any negative campaigning in that ward. And Atkinson, who was one of his opponents, was there, and there was a lot of applauding for the fact that there wasn't a negative campaign in that ward. We're talking about races that are decided by 200 votes. I mean, there's just no room. Everybody knows everybody. Everybody knows what's going on. I think we as journalists might be able to take this as a moment to get ahead with our fact-checking, to get ahead of these stories and say, well, what is the story with the frat house? And before, instead of waiting for it to break in a negative campaign, what is the story with Tillotson's fraud conviction? What rocks can we look under to set the agenda before the campaigning takes over, would be my thinking.
Well, Charles, Amanda said something that I at least think was responsible for the Republican National Committee ad getting the reception that it did, because the commercial that appeared last week, and it's now pretty thoroughly gone. It's difficult to find anymore, had basically edited the audio of the argument before the Supreme Court to make it sound as if the Solicitor General, in other words, the person who was arguing in favor of the Affordable Care Act, was taking more pauses, was saying more ums, was drinking more water than in fact truly was the case. That was discovered in multiple places, but essentially by journalists who said, hey, wait a minute. So do you think what's happening on the local level has any chance at all of happening on the national level?
Oh, no. in fact, I think we can expect more of the same and worse during the election campaign. National politics are their own hothouse, and they really have a different ethic and a different standard, I think, as far as fact-finding. I think Amanda's quite right. I mean, we're talking about running among friends in a city the size of Columbia.
In a nonpartisan race.
In a nonpartisan race, in a non-party identified race, where we should be above this. And frankly, I think we need just a collective timeout. It's been growing now for a couple of years and getting more and more caustic. And we are neighbors and friends, I mean, most of us. And even if we disagree politically about city issues, which many of us do, that doesn't mean we don't live together. I mean, it's not that distant anonymity of a national campaign. And so I think that's why I think it spoke to the results last night. I think people were deeply offended by it. And I talked to people who are firmly in both camps who were deeply offended by it, just as a tactic. It is in no way indicative of the national landscape, except I think we are all suffering from this temptation to turn everything into an ideological holy war, when in fact some things are just simple, straightforward political issues that need solving.
Amanda, a lot of the research, at least that I've been able to look at, is kind of equivocal. I mean, you've got a group of scholars and pretty decent studies that say negative campaigning works. And then you've got another group of scholars and another pretty decent set of studies that say, no, negative campaigning really doesn't work, especially if people have already made up their minds. Do you have any sense about at a national level, why that might be the case when locally we seem to be thinking in a different way?
I think there's a lot of room for obfuscation, for us not really knowing what's going on at the national level. And so there's more believability there. We really know what's happening here, and we can tell when somebody's trying to pull one over on us. So I think that, you know, whereas the Affordable Care Act is a situation where a lot of people feel like they don't quite understand it. So that's really ripe for negative campaigning because so many people don't have a baseline understanding of it. Whereas when we're talking about local issues, most of us have a pretty good idea of what's going on.
Okay. Well, Charles, you and I have absolutely delighted in keeping up with the latest happenings on the Murdoch scandal. But I must admit, I was taken by surprise this morning when I read, and I know this actually happened yesterday, that James Murdoch had stepped down as board chair of B Sky B. First, what do you think this portends for News Corp as a corporate entity? And then do you think that this means that this scandal is any closer at all to, quote, crossing the pond and come to visiting us in the U.S.?
I don't know. I mean, the Murdoch resignation from B Sky B may be a way of sort of dealing with that in a way that would sort of tamper down ideas of it crossing the pond. But I thought they were both amazing developments. There were two different developments. One, the Murdoch resignation from B Sky B. The other one was politicians starting to talk about having a public interest hearing as to whether or not Fox, not Fox, did I say Fox? Whether the Murdoch Corporation is the English term you mentioned in the opening, which is so wonderfully British, fit and proper, which in American parlance would be under the Communications Act of 1934, would be are they operating in the public interest, necessity, and convenience? The difference, though, that language in the United States rings hollow these days because there aren't any hearings about public interest standards. There are what are called comparative preference hearings, but that means if you have a license, you keep a license generally. There's never been a broadcast license removed for public interest grounds in the history of the United States. We haven't gone into these waters in Great Britain, so it'll be very interesting to see if there's a fit and proper proceeding. That means days of testimony and ultimately a decision, a regulatory decision as to whether they keep their license or not. And if that happens, as a fan of this soap opera, this would be like the Downton Abbey of the Murdoch affair. I mean, this is going to be great drama. And I will be tuned in. You can rest assured I will be tuned in. I remember a year ago or more, Mike and you and I talking about this beginning opening salvo. And I said, it won't touch the younger Murdoch. And if it does, we will know that we are in truly uncharted waters. And here we are.
Well, I mean, I think one of the things that sort of undergirds all of this is in Britain, at least as I understand things correctly, we've got them not just with bad behavior. Apparently, there's illegal behavior going on. And I wonder if the distinction between, oh, they're just behaving badly, as opposed to they're behaving so badly, we've crossed the line over into illegality, is going to make any difference in terms of how either this is going to proceed or sort of the impetus, I think, for it to cross the pond and start looking at Murdoch holdings in the U.S., which are some pretty pricey journalistic real estate. I mean, he paid big time for them.
Mm-hmm. I think that we'll all just have to watch and see what happens over there, especially in terms of this idea of, well, how bad is it if you don't get caught? And then at what point do we say, okay, you know, this is something that is probably going on here as well, and we're just not looking in the right places.
I will say I'm no longer making predictions on this exactly. Whole episode because it has gotten so much worse than I ever could have possibly predicted.
Yeah, I think this is one of those things where every time we think we're going out on a limb, and then I can hear somebody vigorously sawing the branch off behind us. Well, I have to admit that one of my favorite books in the past decade has been Mary Graham's Democracy by Disclosure, which is a set of case studies on how the provision of just information has changed everything from the way we shop to the amount of particulate matter various manufacturers dump into the atmosphere. So I have to admit that when I saw the stories coming out of China about the impact of an independent investigation on working conditions at Apple manufacturing plants there, I wondered about just the impact of information on the way that Apple does and will apparently do in the future business. But I also wondered about the impact as accurate as opposed to truthful information, because, of course, journalistically, there's been a lot of investigative work about this that hasn't been retracted and a lot of This American Life that has been retracted. So, Charles, I sort of want to start you out and say, what impact do you think the media coverage of this has actually had on what's now occurring in China?
Oh, I think all kinds of impact. I love Graham's book, too. My students read it in class, in fact. And one of the arguments she makes is that disclosure begins the race to the top. People start saying, oh, well, you think you're disclosing stuff. Watch me disclose. And then after a while, it becomes sort of a PR war to see who's going to come cleaner, right? To say that that's going to take place in China is maybe asking a lot based on cultural differences and the fact that their manufacturing sector is based at least in part on exploitative labor practices. To say that that's suddenly going to clean itself up in a year or so is idealistic to the point of absurdity. But there are positive things happening on the ground that were not happening on the ground only months ago. At least some of that has to do with the glare of publicity. Right. I always think the companion work to Graham's disclosure should be the power of publicity, because publicity is unintended disclosure. There's a difference between that which you voluntarily reveal and that which is revealed about you. And what we're seeing here is a company in Foxconn, but also a host of subsidiaries and other providers of Apple parts that are all getting extraordinary pressure from their daddy across the pond, who's saying, I'm not going to have this story as a public relations nightmare, so you're going to have to clean up. And all of that is stemming from both This American Life, the New York Times coverage. There's a whole soup of stuff here that's probably playing out. But, yeah, it's a live public relations battle playing out probably behind the scenes with Apple leaning very hard on suppliers.
Amanda, one of the things that this made me think about a lot is the difference between accuracy and truth. Because in the This American Life segment, Mr. Daisy had, all of these instances of things that had happened. And it turned out that the specific things that he said had happened to him were inaccurate. However, these same things apparently were happening big time in China. And so hence, the This American Life segment was inaccurate. His argument back was, well, I'm telling a different sort of truth. And now we're going, maybe this is actually really true. So how do we parse this all out?
Well, to me, it's a difference between looking at an episode and maybe that episode was not true versus the theme, which we have a hard time focusing on. And journalists tend to focus on the episodes versus the bigger theme. And clearly, he was onto something and the bigger theme is correct. But what we look for is like, okay, well, what is going on in that individual basis on the day-to-day, and try to, nail that down. When really, in this case, there's a thematic picture that is bigger, much bigger than that story.
Okay. Well, one of the best things about Views of the News from my point of view is that I get a chance to catch up with the work of my colleagues and introduce that work to a smart audience. Amanda, there's been so much health news dominating the news media agenda in the past month that it was hard work for me to find a single story that sort of illustrates what's going on. But from your knowledgeable vantage point, how do you interpret this raft of stories that we're seeing about all kinds of health-related issues? And what strikes you as important and or novel about them?
Well, I think what we're looking at in terms of health coverage of medical news, what we're really talking about is science. And what do we know about Americans' ability to understand science? It's sorely lacking. And so when you have studies about autism, when you have studies about breast cancer, and the big question mark is, okay, what are the scientific influences here? What's going on in the environment that's causing 50% of these cases? And we as readers tend to say, oh, that's way too big. I'm just going to skip to the part that says how to solve this in my own kid, or, how to get early screening myself. So we go for those individual takeaway points. Journalists know that readers go for those individual takeaway points. And therefore, we skip over sort of the fundamental causes of disease, which are typically environment, disparities. There are policy issues that are at play here, and those are much harder for us to grasp as readers. So I think that the link that we see in all of these stories is, okay, what is the scientific big picture here that we're not getting in these stories because it's assumed we won't understand them, or that the scientists aren't presenting to us? It's funny because you had said earlier, okay, we're going to look at the latest in autism news. And then, before we were talking about how an hour ago a story broke, how they're saying it's gene mutations. Okay, gene mutations, what does that mean? Well, that probably means there's environmental causes for those gene mutations. Is that something that we can go home and solve this afternoon? No. And so we kind of tune out of that. and health journalists know we're going to tune out of that.
Charles, from your vantage point, when we're seeing sort of – it's the autism story that actually sort of got started me down this trail, because I thought, boy, every time something comes out, I can see where people would get more and more alarmed. So from that point of view, are we as journalists doing a good or a not so good or a terrific job about putting this story in context and in a way that sort of allows people to latch on to it?
I don't think we are. I mean, autism is a tough one, I think, in many different ways. One, it doesn't affect every family. And so you have varying levels of interest, probably based on whether or not you're proximate to the cause, right? I mean, I think stories about broader forms of cancer, stories about drinking water, stories about, I mean, when we're talking about science, stories about fracking, for example, are of great interest regionally, depending on, you know, how proximate people are to the story. And I think that has a lot to do with people having a hard time getting a grasp on the autism story. The people that I know who are affected by autism are all over those stories. I mean, they consume news media at an extraordinarily high level, and really a rich, diverse mix of it, because they are active. They're in the acquisition mode when it comes to content all day, every day, on behalf of their child, more often than not. I differentiate those people, though, from the general public, mm-hmm. for whom Amanda's quite right. We need to figure out causes so that we can adopt policy. And that is a really nuanced, subtle conversation that I don't think we do very well at all.
Plus, there's an entire constellation of possible causes. I mean, it's very unlikely that there's going to be one smoking gun here. And those causes are very contested by different interest groups.
That makes it tough.
And that makes it very tough. So not only are we as the public unable to understand what some of these might be, what might be causing gene mutations, there's a lot of work being done probably to conceal what those are.
Well, Amanda, one of the things you said I thought was really interesting is that journalists know that the information that their listeners or readers or viewers are hunting for is basically that, what do I do about this? Mm-hmm. So, for example, on the breast cancer related to long-term hormone replacement therapy, mm-hmm. I think at all the reports that I looked at, which was three or four, tucked in those reports, and in some cases not tucked in, was if you are taking this medication, please go and talk to your doctor. This is a decision that only you and your doctor can legitimately make. In a way, that's sort of our readers telling us what's news. Do you think that that's an appropriate journalistic judgment there, or are we kind of saying, well, we know everybody's interested in this, so that's what we're going to play up and sort of downplay the other stuff?
Well, I think it's pretty realistic, a pretty realistic expectation of journalists that their readers will want that takeaway no matter what in a health story, or else they won't feel, I guess, fulfilled by the story. And that's just sort of an expectation. And you're right, it is rather reader-driven, but it's also editor-driven. A health reporter will go to their editor and say, well, this is a story about gene mutations and da-da-da-da. And the editor's going to say, okay, well, what do we tell our reader to do? Well, it's screening when you're 2 years old is probably the answer there. I mean, that's the only thing you can probably do to get ahead of this. But as to whether a scientist would recommend that you do that is a different – you're talking about trying to really satisfy two very different groups of people.
Right.
Well, let me see if I can put two parts of this conversation together. Charles, in political stories, we hardly ever tell readers what to do. But here we have in health stories, the sort of – I agree. I think it's an editor-driven. I think it's reader-driven. I mean, I think there's a confluence there where we're expected to tell readers what to do. Is this something that should become more profession-wide? Should we actually be giving people more information that they can act on in political stories or in crime stories?
I don't think we dare when it comes to politics, certainly. I mean, health's a little different. Health and science a little different because it's got this consumerist tint to it, that we are talking to them through usually lifestyle pages, business pages, places that have a consumer patina that really politics and hard news crime doesn't have, right? I mean, people also can infer, I think, from a crime story, like, you know, I'm going to stay out of that alley at 2 a.m. I think they can figure that out on their own. Whereas conflicting studies about health issues, for example, people really need guidance on that kind of stuff. And that's where the reporting comes in, where you talk to medical professionals about the findings to put them into some context, right? I would imagine Amanda can also talk to the fact that consumers consume health news based on content to a certain extent. And then I've read some stuff that says we love reading things with happy findings. Like if there's something that says two glasses of red wine a night is good for our heart, we're going to consume that like nuts. But if it says we need to be moving twice as much as we're moving,
or we shouldn't be sitting all day, or we're
going to be
dead. Yeah, exactly. There's definitely what we would call the old cognitive dissonance, where you just say, not going to make that change, so therefore I'm not going to read that article. But two glasses of red wine right here.
I clipped that one out, put it on the refrigerator door.
I think, Charles, you bring up a really important point that health news is often sort of consumer-based, consumer-driven, often in consumer pages, but you know, the real story is often political, environmental, and you know, that just needs to be blown open. And there are certainly reporters out there who are doing that. But I feel like we get sort of like the, you know, the tip of the iceberg with these stories, like, okay, yes, you should start having a mammogram at age 40, or okay, here's, you know, the whole pink slime thing. Did you guys follow that last week with the finely textured beef? Okay, yeah, nobody wants to eat something called pink slime. But, okay, what's the bigger picture? We don't want food prices to go up. We certainly don't want to pay more for school lunches, you know. And who wants to pay more for food? Everyone's already, you know, pretty squeezed pretty tightly. And so I think that, you know, the bigger picture there is really an economic picture. But what is the takeaway in most of these stories? Like, avoid pink slime and you can feel good if you do, you know, and buy local and all of that stuff. But there's a much bigger picture there.
Well, Amanda, one of the things that you've done in your research is you've looked sort of at things over time. You looked at historic trends, among other things. Is what we're seeing in 2012 all that different than what we saw three or four? Oh, dear. I gave you a one-sentence question.
No.
So how come we can't figure this out journalistically?
Well, I think that, you know, it's kind of the cycle that we're all trapped in, where we tend to produce what people expect to see. And I think, you know, a real problem is a science and math literacy, and the fact that it's diminishing, and the fact that we're understanding less and less of the fundamental causes of disease. So we're not going to really have more sophisticated health reporting because we don't get it. You know, I speak as an English major. You know, I'm not trying to like tisk anyone who doesn't get science news, because I get that it's hard to understand. And I also might flip the page as soon as somebody says, oh, it's environmental causes. I say, oh, that's way too big.
This is also an area in which we've really taken hits during the economic implosion of journalism. News desk science beats were eviscerated during the sort of wrenching transition to the digital age. And you had some unbelievably knowledgeable science and environmental writers. We have one fortunate for us. We picked up Bill Allen in our agricultural journalism program. I mean, he's a classic example, a guy with 25 years worth of science and environment writing, who made his way to us, or would have been, I mean, he would have been out of a job because the Post-Dispatch doesn't have that beat anymore, and they won't.
Well, as usual, we have way more things to discuss than we have airtime this week. My thanks to our behind-the-scenes crew, Technical Director Travis McMillan and Audio Director Pat Akers, for their help the past 28 minutes. And I could not do any of this without my cordial, able, and frequently humorous faculty colleagues, Charles Davis and Amanda Hennett. For those of you who'd like to learn more about the issues we've covered, you can explore the links on our blog and can access it through the KBIA website. We'd also appreciate hearing from you as well. Next week, regular host Mike McKean will be back in the driver's seat, while Charles and I will attempt to throw ourselves under the bus without any additional assistance. In the meantime, this is Lee Wilkins for Views of the News. Thank you for listening and have a good evening.